Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Last night, in a primetime address to the nation, and just hours after he signed the American Rescue Plan into law, a.k.a. the COVID relief bill, President Biden described the first big legislative victory of his administration this way.
An historic piece of legislation that delivers immediate relief to millions of people, includes $1,400 in direct rescue checks, payments. That means a typical family of four earning about $110,000 will get checks for $5,600 deposited if they have direct deposit or in a check, a treasury check. It extends unemployment benefits. It helps small businesses. It lowers health care premiums for many. It provides food and nutrition, keeps families in their homes, and it will cut child poverty in this country in half.
The bill garnered exactly zero Republican votes in both the House and Senate. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
It isn't a relief bill. It's a laundry list of left-wing priorities that predate the pandemic and do not meet the needs of the American families.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And the fact is, Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package is huge. And it does aim to tackle issues that predate the pandemic, even if it does so only temporarily. So today, we're going to dive into the plan, explore some lesser-known parts of it, whom those parts might benefit, from small groups to the entire middle class, and what impact that might have, and what the passage of the plan says about how President Biden and congressional Republicans are going to approach the rest of the administration's agenda. So let's start today with Lisa Desjardins, Capitol Hill correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. She joins us from Washington. Hello there, Lisa.
Great to be here, Meghna.
Okay, so put this in context for us. How big is the American Rescue Plan? Say, first of all, in comparison to the other COVID relief bills that we had in 2020.
You know, this is the largest single shot of relief of any of the not just COVID relief bills, but any relief bill in American history. So it is massive. And you take that and consider that that is after the CARES Act, which was the second largest relief bill in American history. And in addition, we had a relief bill in December, which the relief portion was also almost $1 trillion. So it is a massive, sweeping bill, and it is the amount of spending in this bill, Meghna, is more than all of the individual income taxes paid in the country in a year. That is the kind of commitment in here to dealing with the economic and health crisis, as well as other problems that Democrats put in the bill.
Wow. Okay. So bigger than the CARES Act, bigger than everything that passed. Well, let me double check.
Yeah.
Because I thought the CARES Act plus the late Trump administration bill that passed, those two in combination are bigger than the
it's
American
true.
Rescue
if you,
Plan?
It's true. If you combine other bills together, that's right.
Okay.
Then they're larger. But this is the largest single portion of relief. The CARES Act actually came in as less expensive than originally thought. It was about $1.7 trillion. So this at about $1.9 is larger.
Got it. Okay. So here's how Minority Whip Kevin McCarthy describes the size of the American Rescue Plan.
Let's put that number in context, Mr. Speaker. If you put it in today's numbers, World War II cost our government $4.8 trillion. But if we pass this bill, our country's total relief, COVID relief spending, will now total $5.5 trillion.
And McCarthy got that figure, by the way, by adding up all of the relief bills that have been passed into law since the start of the pandemic. So a lot of money being spent right now. But the Biden administration, Lisa, would argue that it's absolutely essential. I mean, they're not actually calling it a COVID relief plan. They're calling it the American Rescue Plan.
That's correct. They say that without this large injection of support for the entire economy, and especially for Americans who are struggling, that the country would see an economic cliff in a few months with or without vaccine, that there would still be a huge shock factor in the economy if money doesn't roll out now. Now, that is highly debated. You know, the economists go back and forth over what exactly they call it the output gap is from COVID this year. How much output or GDP are we losing this year? Some people say that's around maybe $1 trillion. Some people think more. Some people think less. But President Biden believes that, and this was part of his campaign, this is what Democrats are saying, that they have to go big. And Treasury Secretary Yellen is on the same path, that it's too risky not to, that the danger of a continued recession is too high without this bill. Again, Republicans dispute that.
Mm. So the Biden administration sees the pandemic not as the cause of these things that they're trying to tackle, but perhaps as the way in, as the justification for attempting to do so. But to your point, Republicans are saying that many of the provisions in the law now, since it's been signed, are trying to tackle issues in the United States that predate the pandemic. I mean, that does seem to be true, doesn't it?
I think that is true. And I don't know that Democrats are outright denying that. I think they are saying that they are admitting that they have close margins in both the House and the Senate, and they think these are priorities that do have at least some indirect effect on American health. But they're saying, for example, provisions to help farmers of color and Black farmers, provisions to potentially expand Medicaid, are larger priorities than just with COVID, that these are things Democrats have wanted to do for years.
Mm. So we're going to talk about a couple of specific parts of the bill throughout the show, specifically, for example, the debt relief for farmers of color a little bit later. But just to remind folks, there is those $1,400 checks in there. There's expanded child tax credits. There's a lot directly aimed at the middle class here, even though many Democrats are also calling this the biggest anti-poverty effort in quite some time. But of the parts of the bill that the law now, I need to correct myself, of the law that haven't been discussed enough, Lisa, because it is huge, what are some of them? I mean, there's a really interesting one there about a pension bailout.
Mm-hmm. This is a very large piece of this bill, actually. It's about $86 billion in this bill, and no one says it has anything to do with the coronavirus. The fact is that a number of private pensions, many, many private pensions, went bust for years ago, and they have been depending on the federal guarantee organization that guaranteed those pensions to pay them out. But the trust fund for a large portion of those pensions is now running bankrupt and needed to have more cash, or else those pensions, people depending on them, were going to see no money, no checks. And in fact, some of them were getting notices in the mail happen for years. So what happened in this bill is they saw an opportunity, Democrats, to put in essentially a bailout for those pension funds inside the bill. They think that is a priority. And we're talking about not entirely, but largely union workers, firefighters, for example, teachers. There's a wide variety of pension funds that were on the verge of becoming insolvent or had been insolvent. And this is significant because they had been doing patchwork reforms to try and get through year by year. This is a more permanent fix to that problem. So in that way, it's a little bit more fiscally responsible, but there are debates over how they did it. Regardless, it's $86 billion in here. Very good news to millions of American families worried about their pensions, right? But Republicans say it has nothing to do with the coronavirus.
Or whether or not the government should be even bailing out
public sector
pension
right.
funds because they were suffering from unfunded mandates for years before the pandemic.
Okay, that's right.
So that's a really interesting one that deserves further attention, which we'll give hopefully in, I don't know, the coming days and weeks. But also there are funds for state and local governments. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. There's $350 billion in here that is just direct cash to state and local governments. And 130 of that goes to states and cities. Goes to cities and counties. And that was something that we saw a lot of Senate moderates in particular fight for. They felt that cities and counties had not gotten enough money in the last round. Now, there's a very serious debate over you know, some states and cities are in much better shape than others. Some are desperate for cash, are bleeding red ink. Others have made it through largely intact in their budget. And to some degree, that breaks down on some partisan lines, places that were more affected or not affected. Red states, red cities generally say they don't need as much cash as blue states. Of course, it varies. You know, I spoke with the judge who runs the Harris County, Texas, which is where Houston is. That county alone, the third largest county in the country, is getting $900 million from this rescue plan. That's for one county. That is a third of their annual budget. So just to give a sense of, some counties are getting just not just a lot of cash, but a massive sort of tidal wave of cash. In the past, that county has used the money for direct grants to people who were unemployed, who were suffering. Some 50,000 people they gave direct cash to, among other things. But you know, asking what were they going to do with it, you know, they're still figuring that out. And Republicans say, we just didn't need to send out this much money. Democrats say, no, we think that we need to really bolster our public sector everywhere.
Wow. I'm seeing, for example, Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, saying, quote, my hardworking Iowans shouldn't be paying to balance the budget of states that have not been able to manage theirs, even though, as you were saying, Lisa, this measure makes funding available to all states, right?
That's right. It doesn't. It's states that are doing well, states that are not doing well. And like Harris County, Texas is a state that has a balanced budget right now. And in fact, has a little bit of extra money to spend on its own, but still is getting a lot of cash. And that's the Republican point, though, is do we need to take on this debt for places that may not need it? And it's a very open debate.
Well, we've just got a minute to go here before our first break. And I want to just briefly hear from you from another major part of the American Rescue Plan that's not getting that much attention. I believe it contains the single largest federal spend directed towards Native groups in the United States. Is that true?
So glad you brought that up. Yes, that is true. Now, the money going to Native American groups and tribes in this bill, though, most of it is related to healthcare, and a lot of it is related to the coronavirus. But there are very significant provisions in here, also bolstering, for example, sustaining and trying to encourage the use of Native American languages, which are dying out. So this is definitely the largest infusion this nation has ever given to the indigenous population in this country.
Well, we are diving into the American Rescue Plan, Joe Biden's first big legislative victory as president. When we come back, we're going to talk about a part of the plan that contains debt relief for farmers of color. And then later in the show, we're going to talk about a major provision in the plan regarding the cost of health care. So Lisa, hang in here with me. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are diving into the lesser known parts of the American Rescue Plan, the $1.9 trillion bill that President Joe Biden signed into law yesterday. I'm joined today by Lisa Desjardins. She is the congressional correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. And of the several non-COVID-related parts of the American Rescue Plan, there is now a loan forgiveness plan for farmers of color. And this part of the law would pay off 120% of any federal loans or any federally backed loans that farmers of color in the United States have. South Carolina Democrat Jim Clyburn says that's a, quote, big, big deal.
What this bill does for black farmers is maybe the best thing since the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Well, Ricky Roddy and his family grow hay and raise cattle on 400 acres in Raisel, Texas. Ricky got approved for a farm loan of $350,000 a year ago last May. In the end, he used $167,000 of it to buy more land. When we reached out to him on Wednesday, he hadn't yet heard of the new loan forgiveness program. He called a local Farm Bureau officer, but that person hadn't heard of it yet either. So Ricky described to us what it's like making a living on his farm called the Double R Ranch and what difference a loan forgiveness program would make.
Ryan, you want to help me get the tractor hooked up and we can get this started?
Yeah.
All right, let's go. Good afternoon. This is Ricky Roddy. I'm the owner of Double R Ranch right outside of Waco, a little town called Riesel, Texas. We're about 45 minutes from the President Bush Ranch. And today I got with me my wife.
My name is Tiffany Roddy.
And my daughter.
Tara Roddy.
And my son.
Ryan Roddy.
And I got my baby here. What's your name?
My name is Roddy.
And Ralston? We own 400 acres that we raise cattle. We got about 70 head of mama cattle, and they're going through a calving season right now. Got about 20 calves on the ground. And today we're going to address the issues of the feral hogs. Been out on our coastal patch. We got 100 acres that we cut and bell for the cattle that we can supplement them through the summer and winter months. But anyway, the feral hogs been out and then rooted up the ground. So we got to kind of tilt it and smooth it out so we'll be able to cut the hay without tearing out the equipment when it's time to do so.
We might have to come out here tonight and see if we can shoot them, but they tore it up pretty bad.
Thing to do, come out here and maybe bring the dogs, let the dogs chase them too. You know, I was thinking about that loan. It was for $300,000, but we used $167,000 of it to buy the land. You know, it's not much money to some people, but to me it's a lot. You know, since they Congress approved that bill, now we can go on and dream about the other things that we've been putting behind. Like, for instance, on the welfare, I thought about the old baler need new belts on it. Instead of just going and buying the clamps to redo the belts, we can buy new belts and put on it. And then, you know, now we can... mom dream can come true by fixing the house. You know, I brought that house 34 years ago when I was 19. So that's a big blessing. Since the Congress, you know, passed that bill, we can go on and move forward in life. So, you know, the farm loans are great to have, but when you're struggling to pay them, this is a real blessing.
That was the Roddy family, farmers in Raisel, Texas. Now, Ricky Roddy told us that he hopes to buy a new tractor cab with air conditioning so that his daughter and son, who both have asthma, can work the tractor out in the fields with him. Now, in just a minute, we're going to hear from a former director of civil rights at the USDA. But Lisa Desjardins, I wanted to quickly get a little bit of context from you. How did this debt relief for farmers of color get into the American Rescue Plan?
It's a great question. It's something that has been a topic of conversation, especially in the House for House Democrats for some time. The Congressional Black Caucus has been raising this for years. And there's also a separate Justice for Black Farmers Act that may move as well. This was one of those features that Democrats felt this was their chance to do it. This was the chance for some debt relief. They put it in the House bill. On the Senate side, it was in part led, that effort there was led by the newest senator there, Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia, who has very strong feelings of this. He was able to make sure that it stayed in the bill. There were attempts to take it out, but it stayed there. And this is something that I can tell you Democrats are very proud of.
Well, let's now turn to Lloyd Wright then. He joins us from Montrose, Virginia. He worked for the USDA for 37 years, beginning in 1961, including as former director of civil rights at the USDA. Lloyd Wright, welcome to On Point.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. So how significant is the addition of this debt relief for farmers of color? What difference will it make for those farmers?
I think it's very significant in that I think it will save many of the remaining black farms in that, you know, we've lost between 1920, where we had almost a million farms, black farms. We're down to less than 50,000. And a number of them are in serious trouble because of lack of aid from Pigfoot lawsuit. So I think this is critical at this time, and that I think it will save many of the remaining farms.
Okay, so you mentioned a really critical historical moment there in terms of the Pigford lawsuits. These were two lawsuits, Pigford versus Glickman, and a second one, I believe that were suits from the late 1990s, where farmers of color charged the USDA with discrimination when it comes to distributing loans for farmers. The government settled on both of those lawsuits, right? I mean, it was one of the settlements was $1.25 billion, which was supposed to be for some kind of debt relief. But did those farmers get the outlays of those settlements?
No, they did not. They were promised three things: compensation, debt relief, and priority for future services. Uh-huh. They really received compensation, most of them $50,000. The debt relief, out of 22,000 plus who signed up, debt relief went to 371. And the attorneys for the farmers advised them that since they were going to receive debt relief, that they, you know, didn't really need to make payments on the existing loans. Many of them who could have serviced the loans to some extent stopped paying. And then 5 years later, when it was finally determined that they were not going to get the debt relief, they were in such steep debt that they haven't been able to crawl out. So really, overall, Pigford didn't help black farmers in that really it put a number of them in trouble. So this relief is relief that really should have occurred 20 some years ago. And so it's at a very critical time.
Interesting. So what were black farmers facing that brought about the Pigford lawsuits that they say that white farmers in America weren't facing?
Well, the Department of Agriculture have discriminated against black farmers since its existence. And I think in a 1982 Commission on Civil Rights report, they outlined that the major reason for black farmers being in trouble was the Department of Agriculture discrimination, and that if they didn't correct their programs and their delivery system, that we wouldn't have farmers at the end of the century. Well, we have a few, you know, still, but we have a local system where the USDA allow county committees to be voted on in the counties, and the only people who vote are those who are getting the services. In 1998, when I was director of civil rights, 95% of the county committeemen were white men. They took care of themselves, their family, and their friends, and blacks happened not to be any of the above. They didn't get services. And it's been well documented that USDA does not provide equal services to black and other minority farmers.
Well, as you mentioned before, across the past century, we've seen a precipitous drop in the number of black farmers in this country, right? In 1910, the date that you mentioned earlier, somewhat 14 or 15% of the nation's farmers were black. And by a century later, roughly 2017, it was less than 2%.
Correct.
Okay. Yes. Well, I want to listen to a second to some of the reasons and responses to this particular part of the American Rescue Plan. First of all, Lisa Desjardins had mentioned earlier that on the Senate side, this debt relief for farmers of color was really ushered into the bill by Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock. And so here he is on the Senate floor a week ago defending these specific provisions of the American Rescue Plan.
The thing about this terrible pandemic is that it has both illuminated and exacerbated longstanding disparities rooted in our racial past. And for too long, farmers of color have been left to fend for themselves, not getting the support that they deserve from the USDA, making it even more difficult for them to recover from this pandemic.
Now, according to the Food and Environment Reporting Network, this particular provision of the plan cancels about $4 billion worth of debt for those farmers. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News on Tuesday said he had a problem with that, and he was especially irked by the aid to farmers of color.
Let me give you an example of something that really bothers me. In this bill, if you're a farmer, your loan will be forgiven up to 120% of your loan, not 100%, but 120% of your loan if you're socially disadvantaged, if you're African American, some other minority. But if you're a white person, if you're a white woman, no forgiveness as reparations.
Lloyd Wright, respond to Senator Graham there. He's calling this reparations.
It's definitely not reparations.
Mr. Wright, you still with us?
And that I didn't hear much from him when, yeah, it's not the fund added in the last year's emergency for farmers. 7% of that went to white farmers from him on that. And when you're providing debt relief that should have been provided 20 plus years ago, I don't know how you call that reparations.
Yeah. I'm going to be honest, Mr. Wright, that your response there was just really interrupted by some technical problems that we had. So I'm wondering if you could actually just repeat what you said, because we only heard about half of your response. And I'm really sorry about that. So do you see this as reparations? We are having some big problems today. Lisa, are you still with me?
Hi. Yes.
Okay. We'll try to get Mr. Lloyd Wright back on the line here on a steady line. But, you know, your thoughts on the really differing views of this particular part of the American Rescue Plan, because I think you hear in Senator Graham's remarks there, one of the ways in which Republicans are really trying to push back against this sort of broad reach of this legislative win for Joe Biden.
That's right. This is a charge of reverse discrimination. And that is an important part of, I think, the momentum behind the entire Trump movement. This is something that Republicans know. Their base, especially their white base, feels that they are being shut out because of reverse discrimination. Now, it's hard to point to specific examples of that. But of course, with racism in general, when you're talking about systemic things, you're talking about broad motions and not always specifics. I will say this, when you talk about the loans, I was able to get some data from the Department of Agriculture about who we're talking about here. How many people are we talking about exactly? They told me, I just got this from them yesterday, we're talking about 14,000 farmers of color who have loans that would be forgiven. That is less than 10% of all of the USDA loans. So even there, you can see that there's a difference. There, 90% of the loans have gone out to farmers who are not of color. Now, you know, and I think that you do see in the past that white farmers have been able to get loans that black farmers have not. That's why the Department of Agriculture settled these lawsuits, but settled them in a way that caused future problems. And it's very controversial. The way those lawsuits were handled were controversial. Both the left and the right question how those lawsuits, the Pigford lawsuits, were handled. But I think what we see now is something that is a very direct attempt to help a very specific group of people that has suffered traditionally. And there are going to be political questions over whether it is overreach, whether it is reverse discrimination, or whether this is something that uplifts one group and therefore uplifts the entire country.
You know, it's so interesting. In 2016, then USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, Then Secretary Tom Vilsack said that he thought the Pigford settlements, quote, helped close a painful chapter in our collective history. He is once again USDA. He's once again at the USDA under the Biden administration. It's really interesting. So, Lloyd Wright, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back.
Yeah, I'm so sorry we lost you there for a couple of minutes. We've got about a minute and a half before we have to take our next break. And I did want folks to be able to hear your response to Lindsey Graham's calling this reparations. You don't think it is?
No, I would say it is not reparations. And that you really, in this instance, providing relief that was promised and should have been provided 20 years ago. It should have been provided under Pigford. But somehow, although the agreement said they were going to get debt relief, only 371 received it. And they didn't get debt relief on all of their loans, maybe just one loan. So at the end of Pigford lawsuit, many of the black farmers were in more debt than they were prior to the lawsuit. And that's because of the way it was administered. And hopefully this one appears to be clear and that it will provide debt relief to the black farmers and other people of color that have debt with the USDA. And hopefully that will occur. If so, we should be able to save many of the remaining black farmers, although a number of them have gone out of business in the last 20 years that would have been saved had Pigford delivered on what it promised.
Hmm. Well, Lloyd Wright is former director of civil rights at the USDA, former director of conservation operations for the Natural Resources Conservation Service. He's also a farmer as well, grows soybeans on 107 acres and also some oyster beds as well. So, Mr. Wright, thank you so much for joining us. Well, Lisa Desjardins, stick with us because when we come back, we're going to talk about another lesser discussed but sweeping part of the American Rescue Plan, and that has to do with paying for health insurance. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next week on the program, we're going to be talking about the red-hot housing market that's been red-hot even during this pandemic and who in particular is benefiting from the current housing market because, of course, home ownership has always been one of those central planks of wealth generation or achieving the American dream. But because home prices are so high and new home starts maybe aren't keeping up with that, has it been hard for you to get into that starter home? We want to hear from you and your stories if you've been looking to buy a house and what that's been like this past year. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for a show we're working on for next week. Today, we are taking a close look at the American Rescue Plan, the first huge legislative victory for the Biden administration. We're taking a look at parts that maybe haven't been as well discussed as those direct payments to American families or the tax credits rolled into the plan. And we're also asking, what does the passage of the American Rescue Plan tell us about how the Biden administration or how Joe Biden himself is going to try and navigate the overall goals of the remainder of his administration. I'm joined today by Lisa Desjardins. She is congressional correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. And with us now is Jonathan Cohn, senior national correspondent for HuffPost with a focus on healthcare and social welfare, author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Okay, so this part of the American Rescue Plan, I think, is absolutely fascinating, and it has to do with health insurance premiums for people looking to buy on those exchanges. So tell us what's in the plan.
Right. So from the very beginning of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, probably, I think, the biggest weakness of it was that for people who were buying coverage on their own, you know, so that's, you're buying through healthcare.gov, or if you live in Maryland, it's the Maryland Health Connection or Covered California, whatever. The idea is that you get a subsidy to offset the cost of the premiums and so that you can afford a plan. And these subsidies vary on your income. So the lower your income is, the more assistance you get, the cheaper the insurance. But the subsidies weren't as big as they should have been, as you know, the architects of the bill originally wanted it. So they phased out pretty quickly as your income rose. And when you get, they cut off completely at four times the poverty line, which is about $100,000 a year for a family of four. Well, what the new COVID relief program does is it says, all right, we're going to boost those subsidies. So if you already are eligible for assistance, you're going to get more. And if you are above that threshold, so you're one of those people who makes more money that under the previously you couldn't get any financial assistance. Now you're going to be eligible for some, depending on your circumstances. And this is going to have some dramatic impacts. I mean, some people will say you could save a few hundred dollars a year. There are people literally who are going to be facing these crazy high insurance premiums right now. They're going to save $15,000, $16,000,
$17,000 a year. Yeah. So I love numbers. I'm going to give us some more numbers here because so that current subsidy cliff that you're talking about for someone with income over that subsidy cliff, and I believe for an individual, it's what, in the $51,000 range, they have been faced with premiums that could have been as high as 20% of their income, right? And then with this new plan, that gets squashed way down. It gets capped at 8.5%.
Yep, that's exactly right. And, you know, it tend to be people who fell into certain categories, right? So it would tend to be people, you were just over the subsidy cliffs. You made just a little too much money to qualify. A lot of times you lived in rural areas because that's where insurance prices tend to be higher because of the economics of healthcare, and especially people who are older, because even with the Affordable Care Act, you know, insurers could charge more to older people. So, you know, if you're like 55, 60-year-old small business owner living in Wyoming, and you're looking at this crazy insurance policy, now you might finally be able to afford something.
Well, I'm seeing some examples here, like say you're a 64-year-old and you earn in the $58,000 range. Under this new plan, monthly payments could go down from over $1,000 a month to like around $400. So it's a 60% cut right there. I mean, that accumulated over the year is that $15,000-$16,000 you're talking about, Jonathan.
It's huge. And worth keeping in mind that even for people who make a lot less money, they also get a better deal. I mean, there's gonna be a whole bunch of people now who are gonna be able to get like free plans that couldn't get them before.
Okay. Lisa, though, this is only a 2-year provision. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. 2 years. Yep.
And so, therefore, it's not a permanent fix. So why didn't the Biden administration push to make it permanent?
That is an interesting question. I think that they were not sure that there was the ultimate support in Congress for that. I mean, this bill has been really threading a very narrow needle, especially on the Senate side, where you had moderate senators, sometimes you could call even conservative Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia as a key Democratic vote they had to get. So I think that making this temporary also made it more palatable to some Democrats who are leery of overspending a little bit.
Jonathan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, definitely there is that concern. And obviously, if you do it for 2 years in the context of this COVID package, you don't have to pay for it, right? I mean, that's the whole premise of this is an emergency spending. We're not going to find the offsets. if you do this permanently, now you're first going to have to find the money for it. Okay, so you're, you have to say, well, are you going to raise somebody's taxes? Are you going to take the money from somewhere else? Now, I think they want to do that, you know, and they're going to come back to it. And there are ways to do it that politically work, but it's a whole other conversation. As Lisa was saying, the politics get a lot harder.
Yeah. So let me ask you about the sort of functional outcome, even if it's just for a couple of years, of this massive reduction in premiums for some Americans who are looking for healthcare on the exchanges. Because does it not then finally fulfill a promise that even Joe Biden made as vice president when they were trying to pass the Affordable Care Act, that this effectively does provide some form of affordable insurance to all Americans?
It certainly gets a lot closer. You know, it's not quite there, and there are pockets where you still have issues. Among other things, you still have a couple of states that have not expanded Medicaid, which is the primary way that low-income people are supposed to get health care, you know, especially some big states in the South, Florida, Georgia, Texas. Now, interestingly, there is actually another provision in the law to give those states extra incentive to expand their Medicaid. But, you know, then you run into the same old political problem that you have some conservative Republican officials in those states who just are dead set against expanding Medicaid. So there's still work to do. And even for some people buying insurance, there'll be people say, wow, these policies still feel expensive. But yeah, this is a huge step towards fulfilling the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act.
You kind of wonder if maybe the stealth strategy here is there seems to be evidence that once these plans are passed and put into place, that Americans end up liking them and don't want to let them go. So maybe after 2 years, there will be political momentum or enough sort of political support to make the elimination of the subsidy cliff permanent.
I think that's absolutely true. I think they're banking on that. I mean, I think they are assuming, and I think, frankly, with some of the other provisions in this relief package as well, they're temporary. But the assumption is, well, once you start providing these, it's a lot harder to take them out. You create political pressure. And of course, this is something we've seen historically before on both sides of the aisle. I mean, Republicans have done this with tax cuts repeatedly, and it's a very similar strategy.
Okay. So there's another part of claims about the about healthcare and the American Rescue Plan that I want to check with both of you. So first of all, Republican Congressman Jason Smith of Missouri, top Republican on the House Budget Committee, told NPR's Morning Edition on Wednesday about the new law's specific provisions on Medicare. And here's what he said.
The worst part of this legislation is by passing this legislation, it's going to create $36 billion in cuts to seniors in Medicare over 10 years, resulting in hundreds of billions of cuts to Medicare.
So the claim there of huge cuts to Medicare, but Dan Kildee, Democrat of Michigan, says that charge is false.
Let me be clear. This bill does not cut Medicare or other safety net programs. In fact, the bill supports Medicare beneficiaries and their families. Unemployed and low-income Americans have access to health coverage through COBRA, through the ACA marketplace, through Medicaid.
Jonathan Cohn, set us straight here. Are there cuts in Medicare in the American Rescue Plan?
Yeah, so this is one of those times when we get deep into the weeds of congressional procedure and laws in place on how they structure spending. There's something called statutory paygo. It's actually a law in the books that's, you know, because I won't go into the specifics, but basically, in theory, you could get to a point where at the end of the year, there would be these automatic cuts that would be imposed because of spending that was not paid for. And some of those would affect Medicare. The widely held assumption, and I think it's a correct assumption, is that that will never happen. When you get to that point, the cuts are sort of across the board. Neither Democrats nor Republicans want those cuts to take effect. And one way or another, and there's a bunch of different ways you can do it, that they would never take effect.
So I'm only laughing because I appreciate we need people like you to help us understand this. I think I'm still a little stuck on the specificity with which the claim Congressman Smith made about that $36 billion in cuts to Medicare, because that's the kind of thing that sticks in your head. So, Jonathan, you're saying that that is not true.
There will be a situation most likely, I mean, depending on what else gets passed and such, we could get to the end of the year. And because of this requirement, there could be a set of automatic cuts across the budget that would include $36 billion in Medicare cuts. But these are cuts that everybody understands would never actually take effect because Congress will not let them take effect. And I know that sounds like, isn't that kind of a crazy way to run a government? And the answer is yes, this is a crazy way to run a government, but, you know, welcome to the United States Congress.
Okay. Lisa, did you want to chime in on the healthcare side of things here?
I think Jonathan hit it perfectly. I think to oversimplify, I guess, it's sort of as if Congress all the time does these aspirational things. This was a very big one. And PAYGO is for pay as you go. It's the idea of trying to pay for bills as they go. And if you don't, you're going to have to face a steep cut, was the threat over them. Think of it like saying, I'm going to go on a diet, or I'm going to run a marathon this year, you know, but you never actually start training for the marathon. You know, it's that kind of idea that they want to do it, but they usually don't end up doing it. I will say Republicans also faced this with their tax cut bill in 2017. And they also were able to ensure that these cuts never happened. So this hits both sides, and each side gets angry and brings it up. But as Jonathan said, we've never seen these cuts to Medicare be implemented.
Yeah. Well, so Jonathan, one last question for you. Looking forward here, in terms of what the Biden administration, Joe Biden in particular, wants to accomplish with healthcare in the United States, you know, he did talk a lot about the public option during the campaign. What does, you know, sort of how the American Rescue Plan made it through Congress and finally to his desk, and how his administration handled that? What does that tell you about what they might do going forward on healthcare?
Yeah, well, I mean, it tells me that they are committed to making healthcare, you know, trying to make healthcare more affordable. And I think they are looking for ways to do this quickly and in ways that, you know, won't gin up a huge fight. I mean, I think down the road when the pandemic is over and the political agenda changes, we will see, you know, attention to the public option because that is something a lot of people like. It's something the progressive wing of the party feels very passionately about. So we will get to that. But for now, I think they are saying, hey, where we can take steps to help people afford healthcare that don't require a big fight and we can just get it done quickly, we're going to do that. And this was, you know, the easiest way to do that. You know, down the road, we'll see a public option. I think we're likely to see a lot of talk about doing something on prescription drug prices. Mm-hmm. And then various, you know, those, I would think the public option and prescription drug prices are probably the two biggest places we'll see them kind of moving to a legislative fight. But again, I would not expect that until after we're past the pandemic.
Well, Jonathan Cohen is senior national correspondent for HuffPost and author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Lisa, so the last couple of minutes we have here, I wanted to end with a focus on Joe Biden himself. First of all, what do you think the passage of this plan and how the administration got it done, what do you think it tells you about, you know, how Biden is seeing his presidency and the next moves he might want to make?
I think he really is someone who is going big. And I think he right now is leaning toward his advisors and to Democrats in Congress who are saying, we can talk to Republicans, and we know that you are friends with Republicans. He calls them. He is close with them. He has a lot of good capital with Republicans in Congress. But they are telling him, don't waste too much time, in their view. Go partisan, and that will be better for the country. This to Joe Biden, who's someone who campaigned on being bipartisan. But he's trying to redefine bipartisan as something that a wide group of voters approve, not members of Congress. You know, and that is being successful in this instance, but it is a risk in the future if he decides not to work with Republicans. We know the country wants bipartisan cooperation, but he seems to have learned from the past that the Obama administration didn't gain a lot from trying to work with Republicans. Yeah. And so he's made a decision here.
You know, work with Republicans on the Hill. But when we talk about Republican voters across the United States, I mean, this bill had a lot of support amongst Americans. So do you think, I mean, that is that sort of Biden's approach here? Granted, like, you got to get through the hill. I understand that. But is he seeing something in terms of a disconnect when it comes to economic aid between what voters want, Republican voters want, those who live in poverty, those in the middle class, versus what their elected officials want?
That's right. And there's something smart about that. Voters have always been on a different page than Washington. And here Biden is trying to speak to them and to their mayors, including Republican mayors directly. But we'll see how this bears out on other harder issues ahead.
Well, Lisa Desjardins is congressional correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, it is always great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
You too. What a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.